Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 48, section 4, which is old single column, page 547. All right. This is a big paper, a lot of content, and we have sort of big, meaty sections, one after another. This next section is very much one of those. It's a long section. But just, remember how we're stepping through groups of beings. Once we got the intro to the paper, we did the Marantxa Power Supervisors, then we did the Marantxa Companions, now the Reversion Directors. And, remember this is another one of those groups that they introduced you to way, way back in part one, even. So it's a loose end that we've been waiting a long time sequentially here to for them to finally give us some more details about who they are. And we'll want to see as we get in exactly why did they pick Reversion Director for the name, obviously. Don't ever forget, it's not like anyone is speaking English on high and this is some name that's chiseled on some nameplate up there. These are just names that the Revelators have coined to embody in some pithy little designation some aspect of the truth of that being, that type of being. Purely for the benefit of the fifth epical revelation only. Remember how I'll just kind of tease it. They'll mention it in a minute here. Remember how we left one of the things we left off with the Marantxa Companions. If you look back in that previous section, that type number 6. The excursion and reversion supervisors, and they made a comment about excursions. Well, obviously, the extent to which Marantxa Companions are quote-unquote reversion supervisors, they must have something to do with the Reversion Directors. So let's see what it is here, and how it is that we understand in some little way a downstepped expression of this fact that the Reversion Directors are seeing to. All right.
Number 4, the Reversion Directors. Joyful mirth and the smile equivalent are as universal as music. There is a moronchal and spiritual equivalent of mirth and laughter. The ascendant life is about equally divided between work and play, freedom and from assignment.
Okay, so just a little paragraph to get us started. Let's take a little time to get in the right frame. What I was just saying there before we started, they want us to try to give us some sense of of a fact that in any direct way, like we've said a million times, is beyond our imagination. Specifically, really, what this is all about. But they're trying to give you some hints, to get you to reflect on things you do know and try your best to extrapolate that upward to some sort of vague recognition of what the pattern on high is for this thing that you have experienced. And it begins with how they use the language. So notice the very first two words in that sentence. That's their first attempt to try to get you into a helping frame of mind. So they say joyful mirth. Okay, I mean everyone, has a reasonable sense of what you mean when you say mirth. If you go to the dictionary, you might see the word joyful, in the midst of their description of that word. But they, and in that sense, it might strike you, it's like, well, isn't that sort of the, one of the definitions of mirth in the dictionary joyful? So aren't they being redundant? So it's like, no, what they're saying is all the things that you might think about with the word mirth, right? I mean, you know, one of the things is what I just saw right there. They said smile equivalent, right? So, they want you to be thinking of, that which, will certainly at least make you smile, might even make you laugh.
Could be gas.
But at least, it's going to make you smile, okay? Because I mentioned the smile equivalent. But the way they want to use that word is being stressed by adding that adjective. We know that the revelators use the word joy to indicate spiritual experience. That type of pleasure that you experience when your mind is feeling the influence, feeling the stimulus of the unity that we're all immersed in, that's in the environment. We can't see spirit substance directly or anything, but we have a tenuous initial relationship to spirit energy and the qualities of that energy we call values. In just a basic non-analytic way of experiencing a relationship to unity, that's what the word joy is. And so when they're adding joyful to mercy, they're saying, think on the most spiritual side to what, might come to mind when you see the word mirth. You'll see as we go forward, they're wanting to use mirth in contrast to merriment, okay, where mirth has a more unity, at least connotation, that they're wanting you to pick up on. Okay, as opposed to, kind of just a simple dictionary sense or even an etymological sense, you might say they're synonyms, really, merriment and mirth. Okay, but they're wanting to bias the use of the word mirth to this, to the unity side, to the spiritual side. Okay, hence joyful. So they're stressing, trying to get you biased even, in that direction on the word mirth. So joyful mirth and the smile equivalent are as universal as music. And so when they say as universal as music, that should, we spent that whole paper talking about the celestial artisans. Right. Right? They want you in that frame again. The reversion directors and the celestial artisans are two of the really significant revelations about these courtesy colonies that are on all these worlds. That have a significant shadow down below here that we can relate to and appreciate. Then how there's a sublime pattern on high that we just have an initial tenuous shadowy relationship with. Okay, so reversion directors, celestial artisans. There's a morontial and a spiritual equivalent to mirth and laughter, and they're stressing that. I mean, sometimes, humans will use the word mirth to distinguish from merriment when laughter is definitively involved in that merriment. So you can see they're not really doing that. See, they're giving you mirth and laughter, right? See, it's two separate items. Like I said, that they're wanting to use mirth in distinguishment from merriment, but in the unity sense, like I was just saying, as opposed to just that, expression of laughter being involved. And then the other key element is that definition they're giving you. They want to use the word play, but they don't want you to go off on some, very animal origin tangent with that word. It's going to be a word that symbolizes freedom from assignment. Okay? So you have assignment and the seriousness of assignment, whatever it is, doesn't have to be you know, assignment on some remote expedition or something, but just assignment in general. And the contrast, not assignment, i.e. play, right? And what do you do when you aren't under orders, as it were? One of the biggest problems humans have, if they aren't being constantly commanded, do this, do that, and, they'll say, whoa, that person has too much time on their hands. Or, whoa, what we need here is a little bit more indentured servitude. Right? I mean, it tends to be problematic. The idle hands of the devil's workshop. We have all kinds of expressions about this, about what happens when lowly animal origin creatures, are given free time.
Right? Leisure time,
they talk about.
Leisure time.
Yeah, or leisure time. A lot of times it's very problematic. There's not a lot of self-mastery in mankind. And that's why leisure time is problematic. See, so this is part of this, right? I mean, you are working on self-mastery as you're ascending. That's the fundamental thing you're working on, self-mastery. And, the ability to have a mastered enough self so that when it's playtime, it's not random time or even self-destructive time, but some sort of a constructive phenomenon, right? That doesn't happen naturally, right?
This is different than rest, correct?
Right, it's different than rest, right? We're not talking about merely, rest. We're talking about using your time constructively when you're not under assignment. Okay, so the reversion directors are helping to bring structure and hence working with you on this self-mastery effort when it's not assignment time. So work or play, the same challenge is in front of you, self-mastery. Doing things constructive, bringing yourself into greater synchrony with the cosmos at all times, in all places. All right, no more here.
Celestial relaxation and superhuman humor are quite different from the human analogs. Excuse me. But we all actually indulge in a form of both. And they really accomplish for us in our state just about what ideal humor is able to do for you on your rancho. The Marantia Companions are skillful play sponsors, and they are most ably supported by the reversion directors.
All right. So celestial relaxation and superhuman humor are quite different from their human analogs. Okay, so you see how they started out there in reminding you of just what I was saying, that, they want you to think about, a downstepping phenomenon. And, it isn't just, things that humans do. It's human analogs, right? There's an analogous phenomena, right? Everything is coming top down. So, they're trying to help you to see what is the human manifestation that is a shadow of what's on high. And they mention relaxation, like you're saying, John, or rest. I mean, that's obviously, when you're not working, one of the things that can be in play is rest or relaxation, something relatively passive.
Yeah, right. Sitting in a hot tub.
Okay. But we're more immediately interested here, in the more active use of that non-work time. Okay.
And before you go on to the last paragraph, the interesting thing was that they were 50-50 sort of evenly divided.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas which seems from my point of view that it would be more work and less play. Isn't that keeps Jack a dull boy? You know what I'm saying? So that's pretty interesting.
Right.
Yet there's that much
Right, so just immediately along those lines, that the work and play are equally divided, like they said in the previous one. You know, think about what I was saying about, you know, like the idle hands of the devil's workshop. You notice that they, you know, apparently even on the first mansion world, they don't try to temper negative consequences of people's lack of self-mastery by just, you know, forcing them to be working all the time, or at least, you know, a greater percentage of the time. You know, it's a 50-50 thing. So, like I was saying, see, it is very much the challenge is in front of you. They're not going to take the easy way out by just giving you 1 hour off, you know, in every 24-hour cycle so that you can't get into too much trouble, right? You know, they're going to give you half the time off, you know, and they're going to allow you to be set loose and heaven help us all, right? If there's no self-mastery, right? I mean, there's this, you know, everyone sacredly trusts the bestowal of personality, you know, even though everyone knows that initially it can have definite tendencies to manifest in a problematic way, the exercise of that will, okay? But anyway, you know, so they say, you know, they actually, but we all actually indulge in a form of both, and they really accomplish for us in our state just about what ideal humor is able to do for you on your Urantia. Okay, so there, you know, you see the challenge. They didn't just say humor, they said ideal humor. Okay. And you want to challenge yourself to not hear the false exaltation of an idea of humor. No, the real word ideal, in a way that you need to challenge yourself to recognize. You know, again, it doesn't have the word ideal doesn't have to do with the individuality in the external world. It has to do with the unity in the external world. The fact that you can't see, you know, that nature of the Father that Jesus tried to tell the apostles and it went right over their head. He could never, you know, the apostles, it just didn't mean anything to them when he said he is your spiritual father. The only thing they could think of is what they can see, you know. The only thing that would mean to the apostles is he's a fancy material father, right? When Jesus said he's a spiritual father, right? That's not what we're talking about, you know. Ideals aren't just fancy or select, you know, your favorite ideas. They're not ideas at all, right? It's something completely different than an idea. It's on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's on the unity end instead of the individuality end, right? See, so again, joyful, see, mirth, ideal humor. See, notice how they're, it's the same thing. They're challenging you to try to find what the apostles couldn't find, some recognition of genuine spiritual consciousness rather than falsely exalted material consciousness that humans call spiritual. Okay. All right, so there's that. So in that, if you can find ideal, you know, that sort of slice of ideal humor amidst all of the humor on the planet, you will find that shadow that's cast down from above. That you've got, you know, you got to look to just it. Don't, you know, the rest of the stuff is not a downstepped expression. It's a corruption, as they'll mention here in a little bit. Okay, so note that. And then, see, here they are. Sure enough, the Urantia companions are skillful play sponsors. Yeah, you know, there's that loose end. Those reversion supervisors that they talked about in the previous section are coming in here, working with the reversion directors. All right, what else do they say here?
You would probably best understand the work of the reversion directors if they were likened to the higher types of humorists on Urantia, though that would be in an exceedingly crude and somewhat unfortunate way in which to try to convey an idea of the function of these directors of change and relaxation. These ministers of the exalted humor of the Marantia and spiritual realms.
Marantia, just spirit realms. No, it's not spiritual.
Oh, spirit.
But directly spirit. Right? Not just spirit-like, spiritual, mm-hmm. spirit. Right? They're purposely being more direct with the word there. Because right, you have the two substances, Marantia substance and spirit substance. Right? They're contrasting the two substances. Right, so they're saying, I mean, you've got to work with what you have in and play an analogy off of that. You know, again, the higher types of humorists, but then you get, though that would be an exceedingly crude and somewhat unfortunate way, right, to try to convey an idea. See, notice even, there's the key, right, because you're going to have a hard time. You know, you don't want to analogize our idea of humor, right? You want to get to the unseen, unrecognized ideal of our humor and form a genuine idea predicated on that ideal, and then you'll get some sense of what, you know, how that idea that you generate, not that you see, but that you recognize and generate in your recognition, you know, how that idea is a downstepped expression of the ideas on high. Okay, so that's why there, you know, it's exceedingly crude and somewhat unfortunate, because the author knows there's going to be an issue there where you're just going to try to analogize the idea directly. And when you see that, exceedingly crude and somewhat unfortunate, you go, you know, this feels a little bit like the Celestial Artisans paper that I mentioned. They said we should be thinking about, oh yeah, Archangel wrote this paper too. Oh. Right? The Archangel that wrote this one, you know, it's the same one or a different one, but here at least, doesn't have as distinct a challenge as in the Celestial Artisans paper, being very, very hyper prickly with you and reminding it your pond scum in every other sentence. Remember how we went through that, you know, because remember how it was building up to the punchline at the end. They, you know, he didn't want you to go all delusional, you know, with his little disclosure about that there's a truth to muses. Remember that?
Yeah.
And so he was trying to humble you enough, pound you with a meat pulverizer enough, you know, before that, so that there was some hope of you not getting all delusional and thinking that you're God's gift to humanity, right? He doesn't have that, you know, so much in play here. Right? So he isn't as pounding, right? But it's there, you can see. Because again, remember, an archangel is a very high spiritual being relative to us. And so it's a very, very crude contrast, you know, between what he has such a definitive relationship to in terms of spirit and what we imagine, right, about spirit. All right. Let's see. So you know, these directors of change and relaxation. You know, I mean, relaxation is there. But just notice how they're directing change, like I was saying. I mean, this is part of the educational process, too, helping you with self-mastery. And that's the change we're looking for, right? Changing towards a more mastered self. All right, then, get some more here.
In discussing spirit humor, first let me tell you what it is not. Spirit jest is never tinged with the accentuation of the misfortunes of the weak and erring. Neither is it ever blasphemous of the righteousness and glory of divinity. Our humor embraces three general levels of appreciation.
Okay, so before we do those one at a time, let's just... again, you see... he's putting all these prefaces up, you know, and before he tells us anything in a positive mode, he's trying to do what he can to get us to be as far away from the frame that we shouldn't be in as possible. the frame that's going to lead you to confusion, to misinterpretation of what he's about to say. So he chooses to put up front that spirit jest, and notice again he's stressing the spirit part, so spirit jest is never tinged with the accentuation of the misfortunes of the weak and erring. When you think about reversion, okay, don't bring in that element. Right? Keep it away from any tinge of accentuation of the misfortunes of the weak and erring. And a fairly straightforward way to do that is to start with yourself. You're less inclined to make fun of yourself because you're insecure, if nothing else, right? As you think back to some previous event. And that's certainly what they do. I mean, they work on taking you back and reflecting on an event, and that helps to, think, where you want to poke fun at, another person, for how primitive they are, and how enlightened you are.
Check yourself out.
Okay. The misfortunes of the weak and erring. And also, this, of course, is one of the things that this archangel would be very sensitive to, how crude we are in our humor relative to deity and divinity, or God. Neither is it ever blasphemous. And I don't know about you, but when I first started reading the Revelation, I was struck the first time I saw them using the word blasphemous in a very straightforward mode. I mean, that's a word that, coming out of the Enlightenment, it got such a bad reputation as being some arbitrary thing that some ignorant people with some completely false, absolutized notion in their head, that's blasphemy, And so, it's basically something everyone chuckles if someone uses the word blasphemy, like you're some primitive, right, from the Middle Ages, wanting to burn someone at the stake, right? No, the Revelators put it right out there. There is blasphemy, and it's not looked upon kindly, right? It has a seriousness on high that our supposedly primitive religious predecessors, had, they have it too on high, right? Blasphemous of the righteousness and glory of divinity. All right, so then there's going to, if you look here, so there's three different items. And so even before you read it, you're probably anticipating, well, what threefold pattern do I have here? If you just, you go reminiscent, current, past, present, future. It's very almost immediately obvious what the threefold is. So that's what they're going to do. They're going to give us a sense of how they have humor relative to the past, then the present, and then the future. Okay.
One, reminiscent jests, quips growing out of the memories of past episodes in one's experience of combat, struggle, and sometimes fearfulness, and oftentimes foolish and childish anxiety. To us, this phase of humor derives from the deep-seated and abiding ability to draw upon the past for memory material with which pleasantly to flavor and otherwise lighten the heavy loads of the present.
Okay. Now, if you think about it, the challenge of this humor is the least. You'll see that as we go forward. I mean, all you really have to have is memory, right? And just a little bit of objectivity where you juxtapose the memory, with your current state. Right, and reflect on the contrast a little bit. And when they say past episodes of unexperience, you may not be familiar, but the word jest actually, in a more direct way, speaks of a story.
Yeah.
Right? Rather than just a little joke in the moment, but more of a full-blown story associated with it, okay? So you got this whole episode and the saga, right, of it, right, that's being invoked. And quips relative to that saga. And, notice what the first one is, combat.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Right?
Did they have combat?
Well, I mean, when we're talking about, ascenders, right, we're all coming from an initial world where there's certainly combat of some force. It doesn't have to be literal battle axes combat. But
our humor embraces.
Right, right. I was just going to say, but just think about in this local system, the word combat has a lot of immediate meaning, right? The rebellion, the war on high.
That may not be so humorous.
But. Right. But they are going to, think back on that. They're not going to pretend that that didn't happen 200,000 years ago. So even the horrors that might be literal material combat on a nativity sphere, in the next life, you're removed from all the blood and gore and guts, okay, of it, and you can reflect upon it objectively. Remember that day when I got my head lobbed off, in that battle.
Now my whole body rolls. I've
learned to duck now. If I had lived, there would have been wisdom that would have resulted from that. But there's wisdom, even though you didn't live, because of course you do live. You really live, right? Yeah. You go on to the next life, right? And if you don't remember it, you look it up in the records, and it becomes, you're going to wonder, how did I die, right? You're going to look that up in the records, even if you can't remember it, right? You're going to look it up.
I got beheaded.
I got beheaded. All right, but and then the word you'll see a lot, is struggle. Yeah. Because remember, this whole bit about if you're going to make progress on self-mastery, it's the 8 steps to progress. Doesn't matter what progress we're talking about. Effort, struggle, conflict is how that process begins, right? It's got faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress, right? Right. But it all starts with effort, struggle, conflict. So it's important to objectively take a hold of that struggle and use it positively. So they're doing that. For us, animal origin fear, everyone's got that in play. And then, reminding you about anxiety, and that the challenge of thinking about anxiety objectively. There's no way, don't feel guilty because you felt anxious one time, but just recognize that's what children do. Children are anxious. It's just a simple reminder, you're not an adult of God. Is there anything that you've ever been anxious about in this life, right? Simple reminder that you're just a child of God. And you're working to mature beyond such foolish and childish anxiety.
But even in the next life?
Even in the next, especially on the first mansion world, you're still very much struggling with simple things like that, right? Okay? The foundations of fear that you began with, anxiety, those things are still certainly in great play on the first mansion world. Well, I mean, you won't have, the literal, animal nature fear, but your animal origin. I mean, you have a mind that still is very much the result of that which is seated on fear in this life, right? And you're trying to still struggle up above that starting point. You don't have new animal fear being pumped in up there, right? Because you don't serve two masters, right? You cut off that master. But your mind is still predicated on that. You've got to mature up from that.
Yep. Well, I was basically going to say a similar thing, that it's the value of it, of looking back and seeing the humor of prior things, because we're still dealing with the same things, only on a different level.
Yeah.
And looking back, you say, well, gosh, I lived through that, and I thought it was going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it did.
Right, right.
It's a matter of
fact. Yeah.
Catching on, Gene.
But the value of it is, well, I lived through that, I can live through this. You know, you draw from that experience and move forward.
Right. Yeah, and along that line of why the word fear is important to be in the mix here, is the foundation of your mastered self is focus, right? A mastered self still has that same kind of energy phenomenon in its mind. It's just that it's not fear anymore, it's focus. You know, a mastered fear is focus. So, you know, and just thinking that way, you know, rather than trying to somehow divorce yourself from fear, you know, no, master it, right? Don't try to run away from it. You need to face it, take a hold of it, and turn it around 180 degrees, and you know, you take the reins of it rather than the matter, right? Having the reins of it. You need to take the reins of that phase of your mind.
Become the master.
Right? And because if you don't, all the higher stuff that a master itself does can't happen. It begins with the ability to focus in. Right, that's the foundation of the whole objective engagement of something. You know, if you're so unity consciousness biased, you know, that you're just a constant fuzz and can't focus on anything, self-mastery is impossible. Completely impossible. Right? It all begins with being able to focus. You know, and you see that people, you know, saying when you know, you watch some immature human, you know, struggling with some situation, and you kind of just want to scream out, "Focus, kid, focus!" Right, right, right. I mean, that you know, that's the fundamental problem. You know, either it's just getting worse and worse. Right, you know, they got to pull back on the reins and they got to focus on what's in front of them. All right. All right. Let's see. So to us, this phase of humor derives from the deep-seated and abiding ability to draw from the past. You know, just notice how they're stressing. See again that you don't want to try to somehow leave the past behind. Abiding, right? You need to face the facts of the past and become their master. You know, turn all facts into a positive. That's what a mastered self does. The Supreme Being is a very mastered self. It takes any set of facts in the universe and uses them for positive ends. Doesn't matter what it is. Be a system rebellion. Doesn't matter. Takes those facts and uses them for positive end. All right? That's what a mastered self does. You know, there's no situation that's hopeless, you know, lacking all potential. All right, so you're going to draw upon the past. So find material with which pleasantly to flavor and otherwise lighten the heavy loads of the present. So you see, it's not just about sort of going back and being in the past, right? It's, you know, it's fundamentally about you have an issue in the present, but you're the primary source of what you need to deal with the present is the past. And so you see where this is going to go. You know, you're always going to be doing something with the present, more positively. Are you going to, is the main material going to come from the past, from the present, or the future?
Past.
Right? And this is the one where you're using the past. The next one, they're obviously going to use the present for the present more directly. Right? So, and, you know, one of the things this should remind you of is, it's not immediately relevant here, but, you know, this whole bit about past, present, future, when we talk about preserve, observe, conserve, you know, those three Latin constructions of, you know, that preserve is about the past, observe is about the present, conserve is about the future. You know, just the spirit of that difference is in play here, right? This abiding, right? There are some things that want you need about the past that need to be preserved so that you have them, right, as an ongoing source of useful material. And then there's things about just observing the present. You know, and then there's where you're thinking more about how things project forward into the future. Like conserve. Okay?
So if we, as they tell us here, we find humor in our experiences of struggle, fear, foolishness, and anxiety, we're going to have a lot of laughing and have a lot of humor up there. Not yeah. happy, but humor.
Right. I mean, you know, and
just because we've had so much of it, where our lives are dominated, or hopefully not, but they say we're dominated.
Right, right. You can't help but be dominated by a lot of unnecessary worry. Right.
That was supposed to be a joke. You know, but, how much of it we're going to have.
But, you know, just like Jean said, I mean, think about the power of being able to look back objectively and chuckle about your death. Right? You know, when that's an easily objectifiable fact. I mean, you know, remember how they say that really is the fundamental way that you can found an ongoing life. You know, when you are in the wake of your death, and that's out of the way for the first time, you know, and you recognize that you are still alive. It's just so much easier to be objective about everything when that isn't just sort of always in the back of your mind haunting your objectivity and corrupting your objectivity, that fear of death. So once you can put that in the rearview mirror, things can start to move forward. All right, so what about number two here?
Two.
Oh, is there a question on the webinar?
Yeah,
okay, I'm sorry.
It's directly related to what you've just been saying, but Winston wants to know about the linear aspect of our thinking and how it applies to the past and the present, and does that give us more capability to be able to synthesize more?
I mean, you notice, you know, when you think about past, present, and future, you're doing that thing about line, you know, drawing a line, you know, to understand. And you say, well, I thought when we went to the next life, we start to kind of leave behind thinking so temporally. We start to think more holistically. But what we're not really trying to understand the science of reality here, right? We're trying to use appearance to our benefit. You know, time is an appearance of our experience, right? And, you know, and like they're just talking about here, you look, you know, back then, there was something happening that appeared to require anxiety on your part, right? It appeared that that was an appropriate thing, to be anxious. But you look back and you recognize, no, I didn't have to be anxious. But at the time, it seemed there was just, there was nothing inappropriate about it. It seemed totally appropriate. There was this definite thing, you know, and you'd be foolish to not be anxious about this situation, right? But to be able to get more objective about that, to not be so ruled by how things appear, but to be able to go beyond that and to deal with things in a more objective fashion as they really are. The world really isn't going to hell in a handbasket, no matter how much it might appear to be. Right? The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. You know, your wild imagination is not going to bear fruit, right? I mean, it's not going to end up like you can imagine. You know, that this is going to be horrible, right, or whatever, you know, whatever fear, you know, is driving your imagination, right? It may appear that way, but can you know that things aren't as they appear? Right? The universe is dominated by a universal harmony, period, end of story.
Yeah. When your gut hurts from laughing, then you'll know what's
up. Okay. All right, so yeah, there, I mean, there, you're drawing upon the linearity of appearance here, right? That's an important part of the thing. You're dealing with appearance. Okay.
Two, current humor. The senselessness of much that so often causes us serious concern. The joy at discovering the unimportance of much of our serious personal anxiety. We are most appreciative of this phase of humor when we are best able to discount the anxieties of the present in favor of the certainties of the future.
Okay, so going from the first one to this one, notice, especially with that last line, you get it, that this is going to require more personality consciousness. You know, to discount the anxieties of the present in favor of the certainties of the future. Well, there are no certainties of the future if you don't have definitive foresight. Right? Just your mindal self, in and of itself, doesn't have foresight. It's your personalized self that has foresight.
Right? And so, faith, right?
Well, yeah, and faith. But here, you know, the main point is just to be able to see. Faith is what you use when you don't have foresight. I don't need faith if I have foresight. If I know the thing's okay, I don't have to just, well, I have no idea what's coming. I just have to hold on right now. Right? I don't have to merely do the faith thing. Right? If I have foresight, I can mature that faith into trust. You know, which is going from a child to an adult. Right, faith is for you as a child. Okay, now you're always a child relative to infinity and eternity, right? So there's always a need for faith, right? But the point is, you don't stay with the lowest exercise of faith, right? At the lowest level of ignorance.
They have some other phrase in the book where it's uncertainty with certainty. Remember that?
Right, right, and that's right.
Which to me right. Always meant that, you know, like in this, it means that. Well, okay, if it doesn't work out the way I want to, in the long run, it all works out anyway. In other words, like,
Yeah, but that's the next one. Headed. We aren't there yet. That's the next item. That's number three.
The future.
Right. Yeah, that's item three. But just right here, you're just the ability in the present to have definitive foresight. Okay, so. So that's going to require a greater personality functioning. It's going to, right now, as you reflect on these three, the first one should be the most understandable. The second one should be getting to be a little bit more abstract, and the third one should be quite abstract, right? Because they progressively require more and more personality-like consciousness rather than just the functioning of an animal mind or, you know, a mindal self. To appreciate what's going on here, okay? All right, so now the immediacy of the senselessness of much that so often causes us serious concern. The joy at discovering the unimportance of much of our serious personal anxiety. Okay, the key thing here is to be able to face the fact, I mean, it's one thing to look back and think about how something in the past was meaningless. That doesn't require a lot of objectivity because it's in the past, right? And there's the present brings in some objectivity just automatically relative to the past, right? But to be more objective in the present, to be able to face the fact that most of your present is meaningless, right? And to not despair, for instance, at that fact, right? Most of the present doesn't have any meaning, Right? There's no meaning for you as an individual. It only has meaning, and it's inscrutable to all beings in the wholeness of the grand universe, of the total finite, of the supreme. Right? But for you, nothing, okay? It has no meaning. But so the more you know that, the more objective you can be about the presence like that, knowing that it doesn't have any meaning, instead of trying to think that somehow there's a meaning that you can't see or, you know, no, just it doesn't have any meaning. Stop looking for the meaning of it. Just dutifully do what you know you need to do, right? That duty to the Supreme, that duty to the cosmos. You have a duty to just be a cog in a vast machine, right? It doesn't have any meaning for you, the cog, right? But the whole is dependent upon the cog, right? So this bit about, can you kind of chuckle at that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, when you recognize, oh, I'm in one of those modes again, aren't I? Can you at least smile at the fact that you've got to do a whole bunch of grind here that's just completely meaningless, but you're going to do it anyway, and you're going to do it cheerfully, you're going to do it with a smile on your face.
Yeah, do it well.
Right? You're going to use current humor, right, to help you with that objectivity, facing that fact that, you know, there isn't some mysterious meaning to this thing. It's meaningless. It's just meaningless, right? But it needs to be done. It's your job to do it. It's your duty to the cosmos. Okay? And that's, and this is getting you to start, get you up from a moray system and a thought that moral means ethical. That your first duty is some sort of an interactive duty with other persons. No, that's second. Your first duty is to the cosmos. And in the context of your duty to the cosmos, then you have a duty to others. Right? Your duty to the cosmos is your moral duty. Yeah, that's what humans have never known the meaning of the word moral. Right? We now can understand what it is. Right?
But in a way, isn't the cosmos others?
No. It's not.
Even supreme being others? I mean,
even? You have a duty to the supreme, but that's a facet of deity, not a being. Right? You have a duty to the Almighty, for instance. You know, that's this meaningless thing we're talking about right now. Right? There's this summation of meaningless events for the individuals that's accumulating. Right? There can't be a summation, the Almighty, if there aren't all those things to sum.
Yeah.
Right? And you have a duty to the universal harmony. That's not a being. It's not the supreme being. No, it's just that very abstract concept to you initially as an animal origin creature. No, the universal harmony. You know, that's not a duty to the creative mother spirit. That's a person. No, you have a duty to the universal harmony. And see, like I said, that's nothing that's initially going to feel solid to you. Right? These are getting more and more abstract. Okay. Anyway, not to belabor that point, but anyway, so the whole point is this current humor, to see yourself just in the moment, how the moment in and of itself, not relative to the past, but just the moment in and of itself in the present, doesn't have any meaning, but for you. But it's important that you are in that present doing whatever it is that needs to be done. And chuckling at it, staying objective about it, doing it cheerfully. All right. In that context, that last statement, when they say we are most appreciative of this phase of humor when we are best able to discount the anxieties of the present in favor of the certainties of the future. Yeah. Right? I mean, there's a lot of automatic anxiety to the meaningless for you as an individual of your present state. They're trying to get you to eternalize. You're encouraging you to eternalize your consciousness. Right? Don't live so in the present. The future has certainties. Like when you look at all the problems on the planet right now, Do you freak out like everyone does, right? Or do you know with absolute certitude that the future of this planet is not even remotely in question? Is that your foundation? Or do you only stand on the uncertainties of the present? Right? You know, and on a planet like ours, that's a giant field of quicksand, right? No, right? Show me someone on this planet who's spiritually conscious, who begins their thinking with the certainties of the future. Show me someone, right? Those people with spiritual consciousness don't have certainties of the future. They have regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Right? There's no certainties of the future. They have no foresight. They're fancy animals. They're not persons with foresight who see the future clearly and begin their spiritual thinking predicated on that certainty. No. So you've got reminiscent jest, then you have current humor, past, present. What about future? Maybe I'll just say up front, so you're off to a proper footing. Prophetic, okay? We're not talking about prophets here, okay? We're using the word prophetic in its literal sense, you know, the pro prefix, meaning before, and the root is speak, right? So just, see, we're taking that foresight thing up a notch, right? Where that's fundamentally what the humor is based upon is your foresight into the future and how that future speaks to the present. Speaks before you get there, right? That's, you know, prophetic. Speaking before you get there. Okay. So the joy of that. Not just that there's a certainty to the future, but bringing in some more detail, as you'll see here, about the future. Okay.
3, prophetic joy. It will perhaps be difficult for mortals to envisage this phase of humor, but we do get a peculiar satisfaction out of the assurance that all things work together for good, for spirits and Morontians as well as for mortals. This aspect of celestial humor grows out of our faith in the loving overcare of our superiors and in the divine stability of our supreme directors.
So it's basically that certainty of the future, but not just the simple fact of it, but some detail, right? It's not just that it's going to be good in the future, you know, but it's, you know, drawing upon that passage from Romans, you know, using Paul's words, that all things work together for good. See, you've got the individuality, all things. Being able to project your consciousness forward in the process of evolution, you know, and not just see the certainty that unity will hold things together when all is said and done, but, you know, to actually see the details of it, actually see the physics of it all, how the supreme from the top down sees it, you know, as taking all those details and how they're going to come together. All the details, how they come together, and just, you know, you're in the moment, and you aren't just saying, well, this is meaningless, but I'm going to be cheerful anyway, because I'm certain about the future. But you have some recognition. You have some philosophic recognition about this. You go, oh, and I bet you I know this is going to go like that and then around like that, and then it's going to come together. Oh, that's hilarious. That's the way it's going to work out. You know, you begin to see how the supreme is going to take that which is in the immediate sense meaningless and turning it into something that's meaningful, right? You can begin to see the process of it, you know, and chuckle at how clever that is, the masterly nature about how all things work together for good. It's like how sneaky that is, that, you know, you begin to anticipate that, and it adds to your ability to cheerfully do what needs to be done in the moment. You know, it's not just faith, it's not even just trust. They said it, right? There's three words in that sequence. Faith, trust, what's the third word?
Assurance.
Assurance, right? See, a peculiar satisfaction out of the assurance, right? So you can even see the evolution of true religion in these three. Faith, trust, assurance. You know, lines up 1, 2, 3 here. And so that maturing process is in parallel with us. And there was a hand somewhere.
Yeah, and I'd venture to say that you actually experience this, even yet today, where you can look at things that when they happen, you know, were, oh God, this is horrible, and then how it turns out. And you begin to experience this more and more, and then you can really, you know, more relate to, as you say, the conjecturing, because you've had some experience in doing that. You know, and you mentioned earlier, for people who don't look at it that way, you know, they may have the experience, but they may not see. A lot of people can't see the good that happens. Like, for instance, they talk about all the good that came out of the rebellion.
Right.
Which, I'm sure, in the midst of it, you know, people weren't looking at that necessarily. But when you experience those kinds of things, in your own life, you can sort of...
Yeah,
it's easier to understand this.
And that's how you get to this. It starts with, you know, oh, wait a minute, I think this is going to be like it was that time before. And I saw before how that worked out. So I can be more assured about how this is going to work out again. But like I was saying, getting beyond having to have had a previous experience that was similar, but to begin to actually see how it works objectively, you know, and independent of any experience even remotely like it, you're starting to think like the Supreme is. You can, you know, you can project forward. I bet you I could take that and work that around like that. Right? You start to have a more dynamic relationship to how things flow forward in the evolutionary process without having to have any experience. And that's when you're starting to get to where you can learn by looking and not merely by leaping, right?
Oh, yeah,
that's, you know, that you start to be able, you start to transcend, well, the only way that I can have any objectivity here is if I've walked a mile in the moccasins. No, that's children. Children think that that's the only way that you can know is if you've walked a mile in the moccasins.
Yeah.
That's a child thought. An adult of God is very transcendent of that.
I'm still a child of God.
But we're all trying to be adults of God. And we're trying not to fall back on that, a platitude like that.
Yeah.
Right? Thinking that that's the only thing possible. Right? That's what tadpoles do. You know, that's the only thing they can do.
You said a while ago we're still tadpoles.
So. Right? But you're trying to move towards being a frog.
But don't let the ego get too far.
The facts will beat you down, right? Right. If you think, you know, if it's going to go to your head, you know, there's a sledgehammer that's on its way. Remember, the angels hold the sledgehammers, and there's always an anvil at the ready, right? And they'll stick your head right on the anvil, and whomp. Right, that's the job of the angels,
to
wield the hammer onto the anvil with your head in between, right? So,
Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
So. Right, I mean, but just, you know, we're trying to go beyond needing such crude methods, such cattle prod methods, right?
It doesn't mean you don't act in ways in which you believe, you know, and you don't, doesn't mean you don't participate in life, you don't participate in all these things.
Right, but just recognize, even if you've never experienced it, just know that one day you will be able to learn by looking. Don't be satisfied with merely learning by leaping, even if you've never experienced it. Know that it's possible. Be trying to do this. You may fail your whole life. You'll pick it up on the mansion worlds where you left off. But Don't just limit yourself to learning by leaping. See if you can start to know beforehand. See the pro part, right? To be able to get, to be able to have enough of a relationship to the logic of reality that it begins to speak to you in advance of the experience.
I think that happened with Jesus and his later.
Well, sure, by the time he's the third circler, you know, and stuff around the Mediterranean, yeah. Right? Yeah. But again, like I'll just, you know, since you bring that up, I'll just remind you again. I mean, how important it is to not, if you're going to look to Jesus for an example, don't go to his public ministry. Right? That's not where you're going to find what you're looking for. I mean, they tell you that point blank in black and white in the book that after his baptism, he's post-human is the word they use.
Mm-hmm. Can be inspired.
Okay? A post-human being, right, is not of immediate usefulness. Right? Unless you think you're post-human
they're
too.
They're talking here also, right? Not just here on earth. Right. And they're also talking this as, you know, our human brain. I mean, not just here, but further on. But as you evolve more, maybe you get to be that
right.
way.
The whole point is, don't think that you, you're really going to understand what this is, like they're saying. You know, it will perhaps be difficult for mortals to envisage. Right? If you haven't gotten to the point where you have logical recognition, if all you have is your analytic mind that you were born with as a child, you haven't developed ability to synthesize and see things logically, put things together, understand how things work, you can't have this kind of humor. Right? But it's possible. You can develop this. Okay. Let's see. What else? Oh, yeah, and just... you know, that we already referred to this, you know, what they're talking about at the end. You know, like I was saying, if you have the supreme directors, but, you know, take it all the way to the top, you know, that fundamentally why, when all is said and done, all things work together for good, is because the entire finite process is totally encompassed by supreme mind, right? A mindedness that is transcendent of all finite processes and phenomena and facts, right? And nothing is beyond its ability to work with. It can work with any set of finite facts, right? And so when all is said and done, there's nothing you can do that you should beat yourself up on, saying, oh, that was cataclysmic. Right? The world is never going to recover, or I'm never going to recover from that. You know, no. Right? It may take a while in supremacy, but no fact can't be taken to good. Just, it happened, you did it, or whatever, just let it be, and try to move forward as best you can. You know, try to put it into the hands of the Supreme. Remember that the acts are ours, the consequences are God's? That God is not God the Father in that sentence. Right? That God is God the Supreme. Right? I mean, remember that's what when you finally get to the Supreme Papers, they teach you a couple things about these phrases they use from the Bible, you know, that we've always interpreted as referring to the Father. And they say, well, technically, no, that refers to God the Supreme, not God the Father. Right? And if you think it refers to God the Father, you have to think magically, right? I mean, that's why we have so much magical thinking, is because we think that a lot of these things are the Father. And that's what introduces the magic into our understanding, our rationalization of it. You know, it becomes logical when it's the Supreme. Okay. Right, so that that ability to really get objective in the full philosophic, logical, holistic perspective, and delighting, chuckling at when you begin to see the physics of the whole, when it begins to transcend that linearity in your consciousness and you see it in a very holistic way. All right, let's keep going. Oh, yeah, something else?
Nina, I'm sure you've probably talked about this many times. Yep. You kind of just lost me there.
Oh, okay.
On the logic between the Supreme and God. Yep. And, you know, everybody else probably gets it, but I was just wondering if you could just maybe take another minute or two and mm-hmm. help help me understand that a little bit better?
The basic difference that you want to reflect on there between why it's not God the Father in that role, rather it's God the Supreme. God the Father is only the initiator of reality, nothing else. No matter how much it might even seem from our perspective that the Father intervenes, say as a personalized adjuster, he actually is not technically down there in the trenches of time doing something. He's purely in eternity, has no relationship to time. And he's only the initiator. He initiates infinite reality in eternity. That's all. The mystery just lies in, as the initiator in eternity, that gets played out in time. Okay? But don't think that he's playing in time. Right? There's great mystery in the relationship of eternity to time, and no one's going to understand, ever going to understand the physics of it. Okay? But don't misinterpret. Don't think that he's God as immanence and is down there actually within, especially within as any sort of a holistic expression of the totality of within. That's God the Supreme, not God the Father. That statement, you know, the whole and the individuality of the whole, right? The Father is not the whole, neither is he the individuality of the whole. That's the Paradise Trinity and the Mother, respectively. The Father is just the initiator. And this is the great challenge. Going to the fifth epical revelation, from anything that humans have learned evolutionarily or through the previous four epical revelations, it has all been about the initiator, the Father. Now they're finally teaching you about God as immanence, God that remains within, God personally present here. Father is not personally present here, so he can't personally act here. Right? He's only personally present on the center of the Isle of Paradise, period. Right? And you might say, well, I remember something about him being personally present in Havona. Yeah, at the absolute level. Okay? But, you know, relative to you, you know, without getting into the complexities of the central universe, because that's always kind of an exception to a lot of things. It's very complicated to understand the central universe. But Father is not personally present out here, so he can't act.
Yet he knows everything that's
going on. From eternity. He doesn't know anything temporally. He can't.
Even through the part of God within
him. There may be the mystery of mysteries where that fragment from eternity, you know, is down in time with you, okay? But to send them, if anything's going to get back to the Father, it's got to go from time back to eternity. It can't go back as a temporal fact. He has a relationship to all of time in eternity only. He has no relationship to time as time. He doesn't know you now different from tomorrow, different from you a billion years from now. He doesn't have any temporal consciousness of you. You know, and if you feel a tension there, it's like, wait a minute, God has to have some relationship to me in time. Yes, but there's not just one personalization of deity. Don't magically make the one, God the Father, do all the things that is illogical for God as transcendence to do. That's what other personalizations of deity are for. In particular, for the wholeness of the finite, the personalization of deity is actually within with you, is God the Supreme. And in terms of the part of God the Supreme that's immediately personally relevant, you know, what you're looking for is, well, I want this personal relationship to the Father to be here with me. Well, not. That personal is transcendent of where you are. Totally. What is the personal purposive presence that is with you here? God the Mother. That's the whole point. There's two overarching facts. There's God is transcendent, God the Father, and God is immanence, God the Mother. God the Mother is present. You know? And initially it doesn't matter that humans blur the two together. And when they do it, they have a magical notion of God. Because it's obviously magical for someone to be on the outside totally and on the inside totally at the same time. Now, you can't be both. It's got to be either outside or inside. It can't be both. That's illogical. But see, now with this revelation, they're finally trying to get us to think about, have better ideas of God, to let go of magical thinking about God. It's like, well, what harm is it that if I have a magical idea of God?
It's stupid.
Well, for a primitive person, there is no harm. And that's why they, you know, it hasn't been there before. Right? But now it has potential harm. Because your magical thinking about reality that starts with a magical notion of God means that you have no philosophic consciousness and you can't maintain civilization.
So when I share my inner life with God, or try to, is that the immanence or is that the Father? Is that the, you know what I'm asking?
Okay, well there, okay, so we don't want to go on forever on this.
I know.
So the technical issue there is, okay, when they're saying that doing the will of God is nothing more or less than an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. Okay, yeah, that they're talking about God the Father there. Okay, you are talking about going all the way to the Father, but just recognize that you don't do that. Neither the Father nor you do that without something that connects the two of you together. Okay, there's not a person in between the two of you, but there's deity between the two of you. Mother deity is the conductor, the conduit through which you have a relationship to you on the inside and he on the outside. Because she goes all the way down to you at the lowest level on the inside and with expanding on the inside to the very boundaries to the outside. At an infinite level of mother deity, you know, she impacts the boundary to the outside where the Father is. Right? So when all those places when they talk about you having this direct relationship to the Father, yeah, there's no person in between the two of you. Right? But just logically though, see, if you don't have magic connecting the two of you, something has to connect the two of you. Right? What is that? Deity. Specifically the deity that is that wholeness within that connects everything together. Mother deity.
Yep. So Winston's struggling with what you've just laid out about God and the distinctions of these personalizations, how to think about that with the infinite spirit and the Son. And those
personalizations. Right. We can't resolve all those issues. There's an infinite number of complexities that the revelation brings up. You know, where you're fundamentally going beyond monotheism. Okay? And if you haven't, the first challenge is to logically, philosophically reflect on ideas of God and discover, wait a minute, my picture has an illogical point here. Okay, there's a question here. I need an answer to this question. Okay, that answer might be God the Sevenfold. It might be God the Spirit. It might be God the Ultimate. Okay, might be God the Mother, whatever. But until you find the question, if I just list all the God the blanks, right? I mean, those are answers to questions you don't have, right? So those designations have no meaning to you, right? Until you've figured out why you need God the Sevenfold, it doesn't matter how many times I say God the Sevenfold to you, it's a meaningless statement. It doesn't help you at all. But once you logically sort things out, it's like, oh, there's a hole here. What fills this hole? Oh, that's God the Sevenfold. I get it. You got to figure out what logically why you need a God the Sevenfold. Logically why you need, I was just trying to explain, logically why you need a God the Mother. Right? Okay, that's a challenge, right? Monotheism there have been great minds who have thought in a monotheistic viewpoint. You know, none of us are even remotely as smart as St. Augustine, say. Okay? How did he recognized many of these questions. How did he answer them? Magic. He may not have said it overtly, but it's the only, you know, until you have what the revelation has, the only way that you could possibly fill in one of these holes is with some magical process, right? You know, he magically had a God the Father, a monotheistic God, who was both on the outside and on the inside. He recognized there was a transcendence and an immanence, right? And he magically put the one God in both places. That leads to all kinds of problems. For instance,
some people did get revelation, though, and fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
With the inside.
I mean, God the Sevenfold is not the answer to anyone's question. Humans have never asked a question where God Sevenfold is the answer. Never happened. I mean, they've asked some questions that basically sort of the answer is God the Supreme. You know, some of the Eastern thinkers, right? Kind of, sort of, right? Not with the specificity of the actual God the Supreme, but, you know, getting a little closer, right? Western thinkers have asked questions where, you know, basically the answer is God the Father. You know, and if it's not God the Father, well, maybe technically it's God the Son or God the Spirit blurred together, you know, in your initial monotheistic God the Father. But, you know, can you get to the point where you can figure out what's the difference between two aspects of the picture where the answer over here is God the Father and the answer over there is God the Son? You know, do you actually understand why God the Son exists? Or you just believe he exists because the Rancho book says so? Do you know why he exists? Do you understand logically his purpose? You know, or do you think, I don't understand why God the Father couldn't do what, you know, what the God the Son is doing, so, but I'll believe that, you know, he does it. No, God the Father can't do what God the Son is doing. You know, have you figured that out? Right? And are you comfortable with that? Are you comfortable with letting go of your monotheistic God that can do everything magically and getting a hold of the real God the Father that can't do most things? Right? He can only do a very few things. Everything else that someone else could do, someone else does. He delegated everything that could be delegated. Okay.
Chris?
Yep.
So this next fall, we need to schedule a total deity class so that people want to learn more about this and really understand how this all comes together. They have an opportunity.
It's a very difficult challenge to get to the point where you actually logically understand why all this deity stuff exists. Okay, let's get back to the reversion directors here.
Let's
revert back to the reversion directors.
That's not funny.
But the reversion directors of the realms are not concerned exclusively with depicting the high humor of the various orders of intelligent beings. They are also occupied with the leadership of diversion, spiritual recreation, and Marantia entertainment. And in this connection, they have the hearty cooperation of the celestial artisans.
Okay, see, so there they're giving you why they're called directors, okay? Because they're not concerned exclusively with depicting, right? They're also occupied with the leadership of all the various things, right? The leadership of diversion, spiritual recreation, and Marantia entertainment. Right? So, okay, so now you know why they, you know, they picked the word director as part of their name, and then they're going to speak to the reversion part. You know, but that's kind of already fairly obvious. You know, think about, you know, have you been thinking about them properly? Have you been thinking of to be a little bit more the ones that are kind of right down in the trenches of all this, the immediacy with this, the actual joke teller, right? You know, and they are not, they do get into that, but they're not concerned exclusively, right? And which is the primary thing? It's in their name. First, they're a director, Right? They're not a detail. Right? They're a director. We saw that with the Marantia Companions, how their first thing wasn't that immediate, you know, companion thing, right? They were more of a big picture influence, right? And again, a lot of those who are involved in the details aren't revealed to us. Okay? So they're just trying to give you some of the big picture items or elements in the of what's going on. All right.
The reversion directors themselves are not a created group. They are recruited, core, embracing beings ranging from the Havona natives down through the messenger hosts of space and the ministering spirits of time to the Marantia progressors from the evolutionary worlds. All are volunteers, giving themselves to the work of assisting their fellows in the achievement of thought change and mind rest, for such attitudes are most helpful in recuperating depleted energies.
Right, so to get yourself back into the potential of the differential. Remember, an energy is a differential. So if you're going to recuperate depleted energies, you know, what's the depletion? You know, you've got a dead battery. I mean, basically, right? In playing things out, you've gone to one end of the differential or the other. Maybe you've gone all the way to the individuality end or the unity end. Obviously, a higher being probably kind of goes to the unity end, and a lower being goes to the individuality end. But you've got to get back into the differential, back into the actualization of the universal absolute. So just, you know, that tendency for you to deplete, see, and go to one end point or the other. So when we're talking about this, their efforts, they're not trying to, for instance, take you out of the differential into that bliss state at the unity side, for instance. They're working on getting you into the mastering mode. Right? You need to be in the middle where the action is, where the energy is, where the voltage is, and you need to be able to get a hold of it and work it positively. Okay? Okay, and they gave you the whole hierarchy from Havona natives all the way down to Marantia progressors coming from the evolutionary worlds. But you got to chuckle in the passing. Okay, remember when they say through the messenger hosts of space, okay, messenger hosts of space. Well, I'll bet you that divine executioners would have a dark humor. Right, that's what you're passing through. That's a little. See, there's a. There's a hidden chuckle there, is there? But if they say messenger hosts of space and you don't remember who those are, right, that just goes right over your head. Right? But that should catch you. Oh, yeah. The divine executioners. Yeah. Sounds like dark humor to me.
A night at the opera with
an executioner. Okay. Anyway, that's just a little, between the lines there. For those who are getting their minds wrapped around the details of the revelation. All right.
Partially exhausted by the efforts of attainment and while awaiting the reception of new energy charges, there is agreeable pleasure in living over again the enactments of other days and ages, the early experiences of the race or the order, are restful to reminisce. And that is exactly why these artists are called reversion directors. They assist in reverting the memory to a former state of development or to a less experienced status of being.
We know why they're called directors. Now they just remind you why they're called reversion directors. And just one little point, again, of appreciating the literalness of language, you know, the word reminisce. Okay, when they say The early experiences of the race or the order are restful to reminisce. Yeah. Don't say, well, I know what reminisce means. Okay, no, but think more literally, and it'll be more delightful to you. It literally means, you know, the RE is back, right? The prefix is back. You're putting it back in the mind. Taking that static thing in memory and animating it again, setting it in motion again in the mind, reminding it, yeah. Right? And it is literally, you know, the word there. So it's just,
what's the order?
Well, like the order of archangels, say, or the order of seraphim, or, yeah. Right? Yeah, see, so they're playing it both ways, whether you're talking about human races, you know, or people are coming from human races, or beings on high. They don't have races, per se, but they have orders. Yeah. All right.
All beings enjoy this sort of reversion, except those who are inherent creators, hence automatic self-rejuvenators, and certain highly specialized types of creatures, such as the power centers and the physical controllers, who are always and eternally thoroughly businesslike in all their reactions. These periodic releases from the tension of functional duty are a regular part of life on all worlds throughout the universe of universes, but not on the Isle of Paradise. Being indigenous to the central abode are beings indigenous to the central abode are incapable of depletion and are not, therefore, subject to re-energizing. And with such beings of eternal paradise perfection, there can be no such reversion to evolutionary experiences.
Okay, so they'll make a point about this going forward. Notice that, oh, coincidentally, right? I mean, obviously a being that doesn't, you know, have this sort of very, very different evolutionary past to revert to, couldn't revert to it to get rejuvenated. Oh, but they don't need rejuvenation. Oh, isn't that clever how that works? Right? Right, so just appreciating how well thought out in advance the creation of, say, Havoda natives, you know, is, or paradise citizens, right? That, you know, that all the rest of us, you know, need this reversion, and coincidentally we have something to revert to. All right, they're just trying to get you to kind of be delighted by how well thought out creation is. Okay, and then the other thing about, you know, a little, you know, if it starts to go to your head, we were talking about where you get a little bit too in the mode of taking your godlikeness literally.
Yeah.
Okay? little reminder that you're a creature and not a creator. Are you an automatic self-rejuvenator? All right. Do you ever get tired? Do you ever? All right. Okay. Little reminder: you're not a creator. You're a creature. Okay. It's just it's true of even very, very high creatures. Okay. All right. So, you know, and like I said, there's just, you know, these exceptions of those that can't have that sort of depleting aspect of their nature, even though they're not technically, say, paradise citizens, you know, they can't be subject to this sort of depletion. You can't have power beings, you know, being anything but perfectly constant, you know, in their output, input, you know, nature.
Their humor's really dry.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about how asleep. Re-energizing, and if you think about it, there has to be a ministry taking place. It's it's not just an automatic thing. There has to be a ministry taking place. Somebody's doing that.
It's almost like we're designed by life carriers, right? And that there's this technique called sleep, where automatically down through the mind, you know, this process works. Right, and to think about it, how, you know, you wake up ready for the next challenge.
Refresh.
Right? But just recognize why that is. You know, you wake up in a state where you are comfortable with the tension. Right? There might be a tendency for you to think about it in the opposite sense, that you wake up away from the tension.
Right.
No. You wake up being able to objectively handle tension.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And once you recognize what you're actually, it's like, well, that can't be just something that randomly bubbled up out of the mud. If it has that property, I must be designed, and there must be a ministry coming down to me. All right. Now you see it very logically. Yeah. Okay.
Most of us have come up through lower stages of existence or through progressive levels of our orders, and it is refreshing and in a measure amusing to look back upon certain episodes of our early experience. There is a restfulness in the contemplation of that which is old to one's order and which lingers as a memory possession in the mind. The future signifies struggle and advancement. It bespeaks work, effort, and achievement, but the past savors of things already mastered and achieved. Contemplation of the past permits of relaxation and such a carefree review as to provoke spirit mirth and a mirage state of mind verging on merriment.
Okay, so the basics are all there. Just notice towards the end, things already mastered. See, I've been emphasizing that's what it's all about. It's about self-mastery. And see how they're wanting to use the contrast between mirth and merriment. So in a more directly unity setting, they want to use the word mirth, spirit mirth. But when you have greater relationship to individuality, Marantia's state of mind verging on merriment. Okay. So they're just using that little contrast to make the mirth word a more unity word and merriment having more kind of immediate individuality to what's going on. Okay. So, not the immediate individuality. It is merriment. Okay, it's kind of the wholeness of it all. Okay, it's not just the immediacies of being merry. All these little subtleties of language that you can reflect on, and how that's trying to get you to better appreciate how we sort of unconsciously have a relationship to these details on high that we don't directly experience. You know, they don't have to coin two words. We've got these two contrasting words, and we don't really understand why, per se. Right? The more you study the history of the words, it's like, well, you know, why do we have, you know, this word mirth? You know, why don't we just have merriment? You know, why is there another word that kind of seems to mean the same thing? And that's what they're trying to get you at. That unconsciously you're sensing a differential that is quite a bit transcendent of anything you can immediately experience. It's this whole fact that everything is downstepped from above. Okay.
Even mortal humor becomes most hearty when it depicts episodes affecting those just a little beneath one's present developmental state, or when it betrays one's supposed superiors falling victim to the experiences which are commonly associated with supposed inferiors. You of Urantia have allowed much that is at once vulgar and unkind to become confused with your humor. But on the whole, you are to be congratulated on a comparatively keen sense of humor. Some of your races have a rich vein of it and are greatly helped in their earthly careers thereby. Apparently, you receive much in the way of humor from your Adamic inheritance, much more than was secured of either music or art.
Get a little reminder, there's an archangel writing this again. at once vulgar and unkind, and much more than was secured in either music or art. Ouch, ouch. Reminding you of what he said about our relationship to art in the Celestial Artisan paper, right? Music and art.
Your attempts are laughable.
Right, so, again, if you are a musician or an artist,
ouch.
Right, there's some challenge there. But we talked about that before. I mean, it's a helpful challenge if you'll take on the challenge to not be so fixated on the fact of what you're doing. But to appreciate that it's valuable because there's a truth to what you're doing, potentially anyway, that is probably not even remotely recognized by you. We have a hard time seeing beyond the facts, and sort of seeing, quote unquote, the truth of what we're doing. But you can at least trust that that's in play. I mean, do your level best to not be satisfied with where you are musically or artistically. Always be challenging upward, so that will encourage that no matter how lowly it is factually, there's a truth to what you're doing. If you are trying to have it be an upwardly moving phenomenon, there'll be a truth to it. And trust that there is. But if you're satisfied with where you are, then there's no truth in it. And all it is a grotesque fact that it is, right? Especially from a perspective of an archangel.
Let's go back to humor.
Right. Okay, so just keep that in mind. But, so besides the prickly stuff of, sure enough, it's an archangel writing again. Notice the fun use of language up front. Even mortal humor becomes most hearty when it depicts, and you think, oh yeah, like a hearty laugh. No. Right? What does the word heart mean in the Revelation? Right? It becomes more of the temple, the upper domain of the hourglass, not some aspect of the level of feelings, the way we tend to use hearty. Right? But really hearty. Really related to you as a person and related to the cosmos. Reflecting the cosmos. Note how cleverly they use words like that, okay?
All Satania, during times of play, those times when its inhabitants refreshingly resurrect the memories of a lower stage of existence, is edified by the pleasant humor of a corps of reversion directors from Urantia. The sense of celestial humor we have with us always, even when engaged in the most difficult of assignments. It helps to avoid an overdevelopment of the notion of one's self-importance. But we do not give rein to it freely, as you might say, have fun, except when we are in recess from the serious assignments of our respective orders.
So they know when it's appropriate. Longtime readers all know that passage about how there's this corps of reversion directors from Urantia. And one of the main reasons why that could be the case is because we're a rebellion world, right? We have this immediacy of relationship to lots of difficulty. And so we can help others to reminisce objectively. But you're going, well, yeah, but there's other rebellion worlds. Why Urantia specifically? Okay, back up at the end of the previous paragraph. Apparently, you received much in the way of humor from your Adamic inheritance. Why did it say apparently there? Did that catch you?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, when you know, as you're studying it, right, it seemed like when we got the the little bit of Adamic uplift that we got, that this was really activated. Okay, but all those other worlds got Adamic uplift too, right? You know, it may have been short-circuited like us, say, on the neighboring planet. You know, they didn't get a lot of Adamic uplift, but they got some, you know, because they had a default too. So again, why is this Urantia group? What's different?
Decimal?
Yeah, the decimal thing. What do we have that those other worlds don't have? A pre-colored race.
Yeah.
A pre-blended race.
Right.
All of us, no matter how, you know, our genetics go backward in time through all the complexities, right, begin in the Andenites. A pre-blended race. See, and so apparently we get this upstep, but it's a distinct upstep because there is a greater potential to be upstepped in us than in others because we have this pre-blended nature. Okay? You know, we didn't get all of the blending that we would have gotten from Adam and Eve ministering that interracial blending, but we didn't lose as much as others did, because we had by grace, well, by design from the life carriers, right, some blending to begin with.
Is it like a wild card?
It's an inherent potential to bring things together despite the default. Okay, and here's a simple example where it manifests, right? That that ability to be a little bit more objective and hence more effective as a reversion director than beings from other rebellion worlds is predicated on that. So you can take heart in the fact that as you go forward, you'll be able to draw more upon that Andenite sort of recessive potential that you have. That you can bring it together better because of that. Okay. Remember, that was, you know, that's the case because that was the whole plan. Remember, the life carriers wanted to have that in play. They were going to use it like with the prince's staff and stuff like that. Remember,
right.
Yeah, they wanted to utilize that pre-blended potential, you know, for future efforts. And they didn't really get to do that in the way they had planned, but it's there nonetheless. Okay,
human so has an extra decimal place.
So just, you know, always be, you know, it's like, you know, you may not be able to initially figure out why it says apparently, but notice that it says, you know, apparently, you know, get a question mark in your head and start looking for an answer. Right?
When we are tempted to magnify our self-importance, if we stop to contemplate the infinity of the greatness and grandeur of our makers, our own self-glorification becomes sublimely ridiculous, even verging on the humorous. One of the functions of humor is to help us, all of us, take ourselves less seriously. Humor is the divine antidote for exaltation of ego.
Okay, I wanted her to read that before they're repeating that aspect a bit from what's above. It helps to avoid an overdevelopment of the notion of one's self-importance, like they said above. You know, again, trying to to get you to reflect on this. Show me someone with a lot of spiritual consciousness who isn't immediately falling into this trap of an exaggerated sense of self-importance, magnify our self-importance, our own self-glorification, and all these different ways they're saying it there. It is the first thought in people's heads that have a bias towards their unity consciousness, their spiritual consciousness, is to think that their job here is to save the world. That is an exaggerated sense of self-importance. You are not even remotely put here to save the world. That is so beyond your league, right? That is so delusional to think that that's why you're put here. You're put here to master yourself, right? The great man is not he who what? Anyone remember?
Conquers right? A city.
Right, takes a city or overthrows a nation, but he who subdues his own tongue. What is the truth of he who subdues his own tongue? Is that holding it like this? No. What is that? Self-mastery. Right? Right? That's why you're put here. No matter what your genetic talents are or your instincts, you're put here to master yourself.
He's in trouble.
In this environment. Everyone is, yeah. He who lives in glass houses should not throw stones. Right?
How do you master yourself?
Yeah, how do you master yourself? Right? See, that's the question. Do you do it by sheer force of will? If I just consecrate my will to the perfect will of God the Father more, will I be mastered? No.
One day at a time.
No. You have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You can't master yourself with science or with religion. You can only master yourself with philosophy. A mastered self is a personal living philosophy. Right? It's something transcendent of science and religion that is mastered. Right? Again, are there masters of religion or of science on the Isle of Paradise?
Nope.
No.
Masters of philosophy.
Right? Because that's what a master is. Is a master of philosophy, right? That's the challenge, right, of the fifth epical revelation, right? To recognize that you need to take that challenge to go above religion. You've got to go above religion. You've got to take on a challenge of a philosophic harmony in your mind, not just a religious amping in your mind, right? Sure, you're not going to get to philosophy if you don't have the spark of religion. Right? But the spark of religion is the fourth epical revelation. The fifth is about why you should take a hold of the spark of religion. Right? It's the spark of religion, that relationship to the Father. The Father, is he the ender? No, he's the initiator. What's he initiating? Right? Your potential to become a personal living philosophy, have a mastered self. That's what it's all about. Your ascension is not going towards the divine light, right? As a pure spiritual drift, floating through the cosmos towards the great light and blending into it. Right? It's not a religious journey. Your ascension. It's a philosophic journey, like they're trying to stress here. Even your play is about self-mastery. Everything is about self-mastery. Right? And when you have self-mastery in the fullest sense, you strike step with the masters of philosophy on the Isle of Paradise. Okay. Again, not what people are expecting a revelatory text to be about, right? We're expecting it to be about religion. It's like, well, yeah, but just in part, not in whole.
Yeah.
Just in part.
Right? Just like the truth of religion.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see, what else do we have there? The whole bit about humor is the divine antidote for exaltation of ego. Just start with that simple thing. I mean, if you're very prosaic, don't have much in the way of spiritual consciousness, because of your genetics, you don't tend to exalt the ego. Right? The problem is people who have spiritual consciousness, you're going to automatically exalt your ego. Just know that that's happening, and you need to take a hold of that. That's problematic. Right. yeah, that, so that tendency, you need to master that self. And they're just pointing out that a technique that you might think about here is actually the technique that's used on high, surprisingly. Humor is actually the technique. You got to stop taking yourself so seriously, right? Like you're saying with the current humor. I mean, you're taking facts that are meaningless, you know, and amping them up with some absolutizing, you know, notion in your head, right? Stop taking it, you know, the moment so seriously. It's probably completely meaningless. There's no reason to take it seriously. Just laugh at it and move through it and go on to the next thing. Right? That's what they're trying to, you know, that's what they're trying to get you to do. All right.
The need for relaxation and diversion of humor is greatest in those orders of ascendant beings who are subjected to sustained stress in their upward struggles. The two extremes of life have little need for humorous diversions. Primitive men have no capacity, therefore, and beings of paradise perfection have no need thereof. The hosts of Avona are naturally a joyous and exhilarating assemblage of supremely happy personalities. On paradise, the quality of worship obviates the necessity for reversion activities. But among those who start their careers far below the goal of paradise perfection, there is a large place for the ministry of the reversion directors.
That's all pretty straightforward. Just, you know, notice how we were talking about what's in the front there. It's greatest in those orders of ascendant beings who are subjected to sustained stress in their upward struggles. Right? Which religious notion about heaven is described like that? Right? None, right? Right? You know, they may have extended notions of struggle on earth, you know, maybe you're reincarnated and you struggle over and over and over, something like it, but finally you get to quote-unquote heaven, right? It's the absence of this. No.
Hell.
Right. Right. This is, you know, this is the fifth epical revelation. You're going to be subjected to sustained stress in your upward struggles. No, we're not moving upward yet. Wait till you're moving upward. Yeah. You think it's difficult. You think it's difficult moving around on the plane. Wait till you start going vertical.
This is just the stress of bouncing around
right.
horizontally.
Right. Like we've talked about. You think you've experienced sustained stress in your upward struggle. Wait till you are on the second circle of Avona.
Yeah. I'm going to need a lot of humor.
And it goes vertical.
Yeah.
Right? Right? You think it was difficult to get to the point where you personally recognize the Father, you know, as a resident of the third circle of Avona. You know nothing of struggle yet. Right? That was easy. That's just step one. He's the initiator, after all. You know, what did he initiate finally, when you finally recognized him personally? He initiated struggle. Yeah. The struggle. Yeah. Right? That can't really happen until you've touched the initiator.
Yeah.
Right? You've been just indirectly initiated until then. But when you finally touch him, nothing comes to an end. Everything begins. Now you are initiated. Yeah. Now you've got a challenge in front of you. Right?
So we might as well
land. It's like, you know, I wish I could touch the Father right now. No, you don't.
Yeah.
You've got plenty of struggle right now that you can't handle.
All right.
Yeah. Right? The last thing you need is absolute struggle.
Right?
Right?
I thought that's what
and that's why it comes kind of last.
We have very finite struggles that we absolutize when we take ourselves too seriously and falsely exalt things, right? Yeah. Okay. All right.
The higher the mortal species, the greater the stress and the greater the capacity for humor as well as the necessity for it. In the spirit world, the opposite is true. The higher we ascend, the less the need for the diversions of reversion experiences. But proceeding down the scale of spirit life from paradise to the seraphic hosts, there is an increasing need for the mission of mirth and the ministry of merriment. Those beings who most need the refreshment of periodic reversion to the intellectual status of previous experiences are the higher types of the human species, the Maronchans, angels, and the material sons, together with all similar types of personality.
So, welcome to the high tension group.
So is that saying we don't, when we, you know, get to, we're the second or third circle of Ona, and we are spirit beings, that we don't need reversion experience?
Right, right. They're pointing out that, the more you get a mastered self, the more you can deal with it in real time and don't have to kind of take an aside.
Don't need the diversion.
Right, right. But you'll need it all the way on up and stuff, you know, to some degree, but just not as intensely as initially. And just notice that physics they were talking about, you know, that the greater the stress at the beginning of the paragraph, the greater the stress and the greater the capacity for humor as well as the necessity for it, right? The fact that, oh, coincidentally, right, you have greater capacity because you need it more. It's that whole bit about... you know, the foresight in your design and your evolution, right? Like, you can see that in evolution. There's shells before there's predators. Before those animals need a shell to protect against predators, there's shells. It's almost like there's foresight and design in the evolutionary process, right?
So the egg did come before.
The egg came before the chicken. It's just that one day, a chicken came out of it, and its parents weren't chickens, right? So just that basic fact, keep going here.
Humor should function as an automatic safety valve to prevent the building up of excessive pressures due to the monotony of sustained and serious self-contemplation in association with the intense struggle for developmental progress and noble achievement. Humor also functions to lessen the shock of the unexpected impact of fact or of truth. Rigid, unyielding fact and flexible, ever-living truth. The mortal personality, never sure as to which will next be encountered, through humor swiftly grasps, sees the point, and achieves insight, the unexpected nature of the situation, be it fact or be it truth.
Okay, so, did they, have they used the word struggle? Yeah, right, they just keep over and over again. Intense struggle, sustained and serious, right? They keep stressing this, like I have been. And then, you know, I think everyone immediately appreciates how there's the shock of unexpected fact, you know, unyielding fact. You have this figment in your head, you're trying to live this figment, and, you know, one day, you know, the fact is face to face and can't be denied. Okay, everyone gets that. Would you understand the truth one? Right. What is this bit about the unexpected impact of truth? They describe it as flexible, ever-living truth. Right? What do we all? What does anyone that has any spiritual consciousness tend to do? They're going to take some notion and absolutize it falsely. Right? These falsely absolutized things that we have, that one day, flexible, ever-living truth is going to inform you about, right? It's not as rigid and absolute as you thought, right? It's not absolute at all. It's you're delusional, right? You've taken falsehood and used your absolute dimension, your personality, to falsely solidify it in your mind, thinking this is, you know, I've got this, and it never has to change. Period. Going forward, no. Truth is ever living, right? And you're a long ways from the absolute level, a long ways from the absolute level, right?
Are you ready to laugh yet?
Not likely that those things that you are certain, you've chiseled it in stone, this never needs to be reconsidered. No. Right? Avoid that tendency to dogmatize like that, right? Because truth is going to inform you one day how immature that was.
Well, also, the rigid, no matter how rigid and unyielding facts might be,
mm-hmm.
there's truth that can be brought into relationship to it.
As a matter of fact, pardon the pun, the only kind of fact that eternal truth can flow through is rigid, unyielding fact. Right? Is the eternal isle in motion? No. It's motionless. And it's rigid and unyielding fact. Right? But and only through that rigid and unyielding fact, fact that's tied to eternity, can eternal truth flow through. Right? Okay. Go hand in hand.
While the humor of your ranch is exceedingly crude and most inartistic, it does serve a valuable purpose, both as a health insurance and as a liberator of emotional pressure, thus preventing injurious nervous tension and over-serious self-contemplation. Humor and play, relaxation, are never reactions of progressive exertion. Always are they the echoes of a backward glance, a reminiscence of the past. Even on your rancho, and as you now are, you always find it rejuvenating when for a short time you can suspend the exertions of the newer and higher intellectual efforts and revert to the more simple engagements of your ancestors.
I think just the one thing I would stress there, it's fairly straightforward for you to reflect on, but humor and play, relaxation, are never reactions of progressive exertion. Right? So think about your definition of the word play. Right? There's a lot of things that we call playing that are definitely progressive exertion, like a sport. Right? It's not play, that's work. Okay? See, so they're wanting you to, to reflect on that. A lot of people, take vacations and need a vacation after their vacation.
Exactly.
Right. Because that whole so-called vacation is a reaction of progressive exertion. Got to do this now and then this and this. And this.
Yeah.
I'll
be glad to get back to work.
Right. It'll be more relaxing when you go back to work. Right? Because there's more wisdom in your boss, probably. He doesn't try to fit 50 things into every moment like you're trying to do on your so-called vacation.
Right.
Okay. So just notice that one little point. How unwise humans are in the use of their quote-unquote free time. They turn it into not a rejuvenating time, but an exhausting time. Talk about unwise. Talk about nothing but a religious zeal and no philosophic wisdom.
The principles of your ranch and play life are philosophically sound and continue to apply on up through your ascending life, through the circus of Avona to the eternal shores of paradise. As ascendant beings, you are in possession of personal memories of all former and lower existences. And without such identity memories of the past, there would be no basis for the humor of the present, either mortal laughter or Marantia mirth. It is this recalling of past experiences that provides the basis for present diversion and amusement. And so you will enjoy the celestial equivalents of your earthly humor all the way up through your long Marantia and then increasingly spiritual careers. At that part, and that part of God, the Adjuster, which becomes an eternal part of the personality of an ascendant mortal, contributes to the overtones of divinity, to the joyous expressions, even spiritual laughter, of the ascending creatures of time and space.
Okay, I'll just kind of let you have that little flourish there to reflect on. But just one little point, you notice they did it again. The Marantia mirth.
Yeah.
You know, the alliteration. And do you smile when you see those alliterations? Mm-hmm. And so just that, but I wanted to get that before I brought you back and did a little analysis. You know, if you just look back to, see, what is that? The back on one, two, three paragraphs before, that paragraph that starts the higher and mortal species, did you notice the double alliteration in the midst of that one? The mission of mirth and the ministry of merriment? Okay. And that should make you smile, that alliteration, double alliteration. But it also should get you reflecting. Okay, why is it the mission of mirth and not the ministry of mirth? Why is it the ministry of merriment and not the mission of merriment? Right? You need to reflect on that differential between mirth and merriment that they set up. Right? And the mission is like if you're on a mission, that's, you know, it's what you're sent to do. Right? So, you know, the sort of the purpose of mirth, you know, like that, you know, what's its mission? What about it is what you're sent to do. And ministry is how you serve the one that sent you. Ministry is about service, you know, literally as a word. Right? And that whole detail of service, see, with more individuality in the merriment. Right? See, so the more unity-like of mirth as they're using it, and the more individuality-like of merriment, and then the reflecting on the contrast between mission and ministry, and pairing them up like that. See, they're always doing little reflective vignettes like that. And they triggered it with the alliteration to get you to notice it, to get you to smile in the spirit of the reversion directors, and then to engage it philosophically. See if you can get the logic of what they've done there. Okay? Because it's nothing random. Right? So there's always that potential to take the spirit of the paragraph, you know, it kind of just feels, and then all the detail, and put the two together in a philosophic recognition of the paragraph. Take the religion of the paragraph and the science of the paragraph and put them together into a philosophy of that paragraph. That's what you're trying to do. And the more you do that, the more you master a paragraph in the revelation, the more you'll master yourself. Right? The mind that can master a paragraph in the revelation is the kind of mind that can master your animal origin self. It's a philosophic endeavor.
So all right. What would you say are the overtones of divinity they're talking about?
Oh, the adjuster is giving you at least a superconscious, but maybe also a conscious overtones that are playing on the fundamentals of the experience, right? And talk about overtone potential. I mean, it can give you overtones that go all the way up to the infinite level. Right, playing upon the fundamentals down there in the finite. And so they're just reminding you how the adjuster can catalyze, you know, the adjuster's always doing this, how the adjuster can catalyze this experience by bringing in its infinite depth into the experience. All right, let's call it an evening. A lot of work to struggle. It was a struggle, pardon the pun, yes, to get through the reversion director section. All right, so now we'll pick up another loose end next time, the Mansion World teachers, and just keep chugging through this paper here.
We'll laugh about it later.
All right, let's take a moment, everyone.